Hi, I'm David Crowe. Thank you for tuning in to episode 81 of my weekly radio show, The Infectious Myth. You can email me at david.crowe@theinfectiousmyth.com, like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth, or join the discussion there. Follow us on Twitter at Infectious Myth. You can download us from iTunes automatically or other podcast programs. And remember, I don't know you're a listener until I hear from you, so send me a message letting me know how you stay in touch with the show, and if you include your mailing address, I'll send you a little thank you gift. If you'd like to sponsor the show as an individual or as an advertiser, please contact me. We appreciate all our listeners, but if you want this show to continue to grow and improve, consider paying a small amount for the information that you're gleaning, for the support you get for some non-mainstream ideas, and the challenges you get to others. Today I will talk with Medea Benjamin, a well-known American peace activist, founder of Code Pink, among her many other accomplishments. I would first like to offer my condolences to all of the families and friends of people killed in the terrorist attacks in Paris, in Beirut, in Mali, the Planned Parenthood attack in Colorado Springs, and the many other violent and unjustified terrorist attacks that have occurred around the world in recent weeks. Now I would like to go through some of the news articles that I've read over the past few weeks that maybe made me decide that Medea Benjamin would be a good guest for the show on the subject of war and peace. On November 28th in Salon.com, Dana E. Abizide wrote, "Anybody paying attention to the facts regarding the U.S. bombing of a Médecins Sans Frontières hospital in Kunduz, Afghanistan on October 3rd, could come to the conclusion that the attack was not a mistake, but a targeted strike. To come to this conclusion, one would have to abandon the belief that U.S. intentions are always benevolent and tragedies like Kunduz are simply accidents that happen in a fog of war. More importantly, such a conclusion would require one to put two words back to back that the mainstream U.S. press would find ludicrous. It is unlikely that the U.S. media would ever consider such journalistic blasphemy American terrorism. But why should it? Even a brief examination of the historical record over the past 16 years reveals a number of glaring mistakes in America's bombing and strafing campaigns. Nevertheless, these attacks have been filed away in the dustbin of history after the American government and media made clear that they were, quote, mistakes. But could they all be mistakes? Some of the examples he cites are the NATO's bombing of the Chinese embassy in Belgrade in 1999, when NATO and China were at odds. In 2001, American warplanes bombed and largely destroyed the same Red Cross complex in Kabul that they struck 10 days ago. In 2002, the American military mistakenly bombed one Afghan wedding in Uruzgan province, killing 30. And then in the same year, they killed 16 in another bombing of a wedding in the same province. The writer believes this might have been due to frustrations that the U.S. had failed to capture Mullah Muhammad Omar, who came from this province. I was looking at a cartoon by Peter Brooks in the UK newspaper, The Times, which showed a man from ISIS preparing to behead someone in an orange Guantanamo jumpsuit under the title Barbaric Death Cult. And in the same cartoon, a Saudi doing the same thing with the title Friend and Ally. I've read several reports that Saudi Arabia is preparing to execute 50 people in one day by a variety of medieval means, including beheadings and stonings. That's on top of the 150 or so that they've already executed this year. Most of them appear to be poor foreign workers who get blamed for a problem that's not theirs, such as the death of a child, or dissidents, and it doesn't take much to be branded a dangerous dissident in the Western world's friend and ally, Saudi Arabia. And why are they such a great friend and ally? Is it the oil, or the arms sales, or both? Julian Assange wrote about surveillance in response to a UK Daily Mail newspaper article by a well-connected Brit, Sir Max Hastings, who claimed that Assange and Snowden were responsible for the Paris bloodbath. Assange wrote, "Secrecy breeds corruption. but it also breeds incompetence, and the French secret services are no exception to this rule. Currently, the French security state has tried to present the killers as supervillains in order to hide their own incompetence, something the media has been only too willing to aid and abet. The reality is that the Charlie Hebdo killers were bumbling Keystone terrorists, no-hopers who crashed their car, left their ID, coordinated over the phone, and swiftly died. To lose nearly 24 people to them is unforgivable. That double digits were killed is no mark of superpowers. A single idiot can do it. In Australia's Port Arthur massacre, a man with an IQ of 66, literally an idiot, shot 58 people over the course of several hours because he was armed with an AR-10 semi-automatic and his victims were not. The tragedy in Paris is another example of where competent targeted surveillance, not mass surveillance, is needed. And now I'd like to go to our guest, Medea Benjamin. Medea Benjamin is a well-known peace activist, founder of Code Pink, and also a fair trade advocacy group, Global Exchange. She ran as a Green Party Senate candidate in California. She writes for Huffington Post, Op-Ed News. She received the Martin Luther King Jr. Peace Prize Award in 2010. In 2012, the Marjorie Kellogg National Peacemaker Award, the Thomas Merton Center Peace Award, and the Peace Foundation Memorial Award. In 2014, she received the Gandhi Peace Award. She is well known for her Gandhian nonviolent civil disobedience, often disrupting events by people that she considers war criminals, such as Donald Rumsfeld, George W. Bush, and Condoleezza Rice. Recently, she was famously described as low-life scum by John McCain for interrupting testimony by Henry Kissinger. Welcome to the show, Medea.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Yeah, well, recently, I don't know if it's more violent than normal, but we've had Paris, Beirut, Mali, civilian airplane bombed in Egypt. The Saudis are planning 50 simultaneous executions and the Planned Parenthood shooting, and I've probably missed quite a few events. Do you connect some of these things together? Do you see them as isolated events, or is there a connection between them?
Well, certainly there's a connection, David, in the whole militarization of our planet. And when you look at the issue of who profits from violence, you can trace it back to these large weapons manufacturers, that their bread and butter is really based on people arming and killing each other. So that's certainly one connection that exists. And we try to show in our work how the money that we spend on having the largest military by far in the world is taking away from money that we need to fund programs that really would help struggling people. And you could make that same analysis all along the chain to show how we're being robbed of not only a peaceful planet but a more just planet by having put so much of our world's resources into weapons.
The message of like the French President Hollande was, or the action, one of the first actions was to go bomb Raqqa, and the message I got from that was, you know, ISIS is a cancer we can eliminate. I mean, putting aside whether we should be killing people in ISIS, is it actually possible to kill these groups like ISIS, Al-Qaeda, whatever? Do you think there is a military solution?
Well, David, what's so crazy to me is that people just don't simply look back at the last 13 years and say, what has transpired since the 9/11 attacks? It was a military response, and what we have now is not the destruction of Al-Qaeda or even the Taliban, but now we have the spread of extremist groups throughout the Middle East and throughout North Africa. If you just look at Al-Qaeda alone, you can see that when the U.S. started the attacks, it was perhaps based in a few countries, and now you have Al-Qaeda-like groups who might call themselves ISIS now, in dozens of countries. So were there a military solution? The largest military in the world, the U.S., together with the coalition that it put together, was certainly not able to defeat these groups when they were smaller and less spread out. So it's absolutely impossible to think that they would be able to do so today.
And would you consider the reaction of the Western countries involved, like France and Belgium, where they put a state of emergency, they shut down the city of Brussels, or at least like subways and other public facilities for several days, and this huge amount of fear in the population, does this mean that the West handed a victory to ISIS?
I think ISIS not only wants to see a huge reaction in the West, but it also wants to see boots on the ground in the Middle East. And so not only are we taking away people's liberties by these states of emergency and doing things like not allowing people to even march for the climate march in Paris now, but we see the greater escalation of military involvement and the push, certainly here in the United States, to send more troops into the Middle East once again. I think this is a double victory for ISIS, if indeed that's the way it turns out.
Yeah, another thing that the French government apparently did was to increase the powers of Internet censorship. Already I've heard that discussing the boycott and divestment of the BDS, they call it, against Israel is a crime in France. And with the censorship powers, then a lot of free speech rights of French will be taken away. And yet there seems to be support by the average person in the street, if there is such a thing.
Well, the initial reaction is always one of fear, but then it's fed by the media, it's fed by government, it's fed by public officials. In the United States, it's fed by presidential candidates who seem to think that the way to appeal to people is who is going to be the toughest on cracking down not only on ISIS, but also on our own people. So you see the polls turn around and people start mimicking the things that they're hearing. It doesn't make a lot of sense from a rational point of view, but fear sells and violence sells. And in a capitalist society where the media is more concerned about getting more people to consume their product than telling the truth or calming people down, it's unfortunate the reaction that we get to the attacks. And the reaction is, unfortunately, sometimes worse than the attack itself.
Yeah, Canadian writer Andrew Mitrovica referred to this as the fear industry, and I think that's what you're describing, is they take the fear of the population and then they manipulate that into greater sales of weapons.
Well, that's right. We saw this recently when in the U.S. there was a Congress debating whether the United States should support a nuclear deal with Iran, which by every measure, 100% of the people should have been in favor of if the alternative was going to war. And yet small lobby groups with large amounts of money putting ads in the newspapers and on television managed to so manipulate the people that the polls went from supporting the agreement to being against the agreement. Luckily, cooler heads prevailed there, but we saw how the ad campaigns really do have an impact on changing people's opinions.
The way I see some of these weapons programs and is that if say the military has the ability to put 100 drones in the air at any particular point in time, then they will find excuses to use 100 drones. And if they then go and buy the capability to have another 50 in the air, then they'll have to find even more targets. I mean, do you see that once we have these weapons, they start to get used? So circular.
Well, yes, and there is a revolving door between the people in the weapons companies and the officials themselves, and the weapons companies have massive numbers of lobbyists who are constantly in the halls of Congress and meeting with people in the White House. So you see how it's in the interest of the weapons manufacturers to keep us in this perpetual state of war, and they're the ones who have the ears of our elected officials. So you wonder how many lobbyists the peace movement has. Well, probably
maybe you.
yeah, really. Unfair fight.
What's that?
It's an unfair fight.
Yeah, it's definitely asymmetrical. Recently, Tony Blair and Michael Flynn, who was until recently apparently director of the U.S. Defense Intelligence Agency, both admitted that their actions helped create ISIS. And my understanding is ISIS is in Iraq, Syria, and Libya in the strongest, which are places that the West has been trying to destabilize, successfully in two cases, trying to destabilize the government. There seems to be enough honesty out there for the average person to actually be able to realize what's going on, but still the majority seem to go along with the flow.
Well, I think that still I would be curious to see a poll in the United States, for example, about where ISIS came from, because I would think the majority would not even understand that it came from George Bush's invasion of Iraq. But in any case, the U.S. has been called the United States of amnesia. People don't like to look back, and the politicians say, well, you know, this is the state that we're in right now. It doesn't really matter how we got here. It matters what we do. Well, it does matter how we got there, because that should then inform what it is that we do. We got to this point by using militarism as a response to 9/11, and we'll continue to make matters worse by using militarism. But unfortunately, that very logic is not something that either sells newspapers or gets people elected.
Well, I was reading an article in The Guardian by Mehdi Hassan, who said that the U.S. government and their allies had criticized the Russians for intervening in Syria because it would, this is supposedly a quote, only fuel more extremism and radicalization. But that seems slightly ironic.
Yes, and also it is amazing how much in our media we're seeing the civilian casualties that result in Russian bombings. And I'm glad we're seeing it, because it's terrible that it's happening and people ought to know about it and be critical. But why don't we ever see the civilian casualties that result from the West bombing? It's been 13 years now, and rarely do we ever see those results.
Yeah, I think there's many well-documented cases of bombings by the West of wedding parties, markets, houses full of civilians, and yet you're right, you rarely see the actual pictures of...
Oh, yeah, sure, and look right now at what's happening in Yemen and how the Saudi bombings going on every day now for the last 9 months have been killing thousands of innocent people.
Right.
And this is with weapons from the West, from the U.S., from the U.K., from Canada, from Sweden, and yet we barely hear about what's happening in Yemen, and certainly if we do hear about it, it doesn't go to the place of who is ultimately responsible for selling the weapons to the Saudis that are using them to commit war crimes.
Something I read recently was that Belgium was quite important in the world arms trade, and that possibly the reason why wannabe terrorists in Belgium can get their hands on military weapons is because Belgium is selling them all over the world. I mean, do you know a lot about the global arms trade, especially the small arms trade, which is what these terrorist attacks usually use?
No, but I did hear that same thing, and it was very surprising. One doesn't think of Belgium in that context. But it's also a country like Sweden that's considered such a positive force and a model in the world, and yet makes so much money on the arms trade. So this is a phenomenon that unfortunately has become global, and that's why it's so frustrating for people who focus on trying to stop their own governments from producing and selling certain kinds of weapons, like our campaign here that has been trying to stop the use of killer drones, is that once this technology is out there, you see the copycats being produced then by everyone from China to Russia to Iran, and you can no longer control it.
I think the idea of the whole drone program is, I mean, tell me if I'm wrong here, but I think that America's had, since Vietnam, a real problem with a lot of their soldiers dying on the battlefield, and drones are seen as a way that they can kill people in foreign countries, make the huge profits for the military-industrial contractors, and not have soldiers dying on the ground. But if there's...
Well, that's right. Of course, yeah. In fact, if you look, David, at the evolution in the United States from the Vietnam War, where there was a draft, meaning that every mm-hmm. young person, every male, was supposed to be shipped thousands of miles away to kill people in Vietnam, how that led to a protest movement led by young people, the military didn't want to see that again. And so we haven't had a draft since then, and it's gone in the absolute opposite direction, where not only is it a, quote, volunteer army, but now things like drones allow the U.S. to get involved in military conflicts without even putting the lives of its own soldiers at risk, having them kill from the comfort of a ergonomic chair in an air-conditioned room in the United States by pressing a button. And the distance, both physically and mentally, that one has from the consequences of your actions is very frightening.
Although, I think, first of all, in Europe, the blowback is some of these terrorist attacks, but it appears that some of the soldiers are suffering from PTSD, which you wouldn't really think of, somebody who's basically playing a video game. But I think there's a new film out about it. But some start to realize that those are real human beings that they're killing, and it starts to get to them after a while. And what's going to happen to all those soldiers once they're back in the civilian population?
Sure, and it's just like the soldiers throughout history don't want to kill, and that's why militaries have to brainwash people to think that their enemy are lesser human beings. And the same is true in the drone program. I mean, how can somebody feel good about themselves pressing a button, killing somebody during the day, and then going home to be the model husband and father at night or on the weekends? Our brains just aren't set for that. But another thing I wanted to mention, David, mm-hmm. when you talk about the drones, is how it gives the government the possibility of waging war behind the backs of the American people. And it's not only the drones, it's the use of special operation forces, things that are covert, that are secret, that don't even come out in things like congressional hearings. And if we call ourselves a democracy, how can we be waging war in places throughout the world behind the backs of the people themselves? And in our efforts at Code Pink to try to expose the drone program, this has been one of the hardest things for years. The government didn't even admit that it was using the drones. It didn't admit that it was even involved in military activities in places like Pakistan or Yemen or Somalia. And so this is another consequence of this technology that is very bad, not only for trying to stop terrorist activities and make ourselves safer, but also the very essence of what a democratic system should be about.
Yeah. One thing I've noticed with things like the Black Lives Movement in the United States is the importance of newer technologies, like the fact that everybody with a cell phone is basically walking around with a video camera. Plus, there's video cameras installed in all kinds of places. Are you seeing that actually helping in some of these places where attacks by Western forces or Russians or whoever are more likely to be recorded in some way than in the past?
Well, yes, it's the positive side of the technology. On the negative side, that same technology is used to spy on us.
Right.
On the positive side, and they have better technology than we have, but on the positive side, it is amazing, as you said in the Black Lives Matter, these incidents have been going on for decades now, but the fact that we're seeing them has changed the whole equation. And you talk about things like drones. Well, we don't want them in the hands of our government or our police forces, but we do want them to watch how the police are treating us at demonstrations or things like that. There is a flip side and a good side to the technology, but let's remember that whatever we have is a fraction of the kinds of technologies that the powerful have.
One of the things that I think is pretty clear has happened by the destabilization of Iraq, Afghanistan, and other places has been this flood of refugees, which do appear to be blowback from all the bombing that's happened, just simply because people can't live in those places anymore. And although not all the bombing is from the West, you know, Assad is definitely doing, creating his own war crimes. There doesn't seem to be a lot of realization that the reason why Europe is flooded with refugees has a lot to do with their involvement or support of American policy on the Middle East.
Well, there doesn't seem to be much realization in general that it's the actions of the West that create this flood of refugees and this issue of responsibility. Here in the United States, it's so sad to see the kind of xenophobic attitudes and the ways that the candidates for the presidential campaign are manipulating this issue of the refugees. And instead of recognizing that we have a direct responsibility for the refugees, and that aside from the issue of just basic human compassion, many of the refugees are the results of our own actions. And as you say, in Europe as well, Europe's involvement in these wars. So it's certainly connected to our policies, but unfortunately, I think the demagoguery of elected officials has meant that people don't see the connections, and they actually see themselves as, if they take in refugees, they're such a good, kind people, rather than they're fulfilling their obligations.
Yeah, and I guess America is somewhat protected because Syrian refugees are going to have a hard time actually getting to the United States, unlike in Europe where they can walk there, take a boat. There's many ways for them to get from places like Syria or Iraq to Europe, but it's almost impossible to get to America without some pretty big financial resources.
Well, that's right. And the other issue, just look at the refugees we are really directly responsible for, like the Iraqis who worked with the U.S. forces, the interpreters, the people who worked on U.S. bases. I mean, we're not even taking those people in. There's huge battles to get those people in whose lives has been at risk because of the side that they took. The U.S. doesn't even want to allow those people in because you could sneak in a terrorist among that group, or just because of the plain old racism that's against refugees and immigrants in general in the United States. So, yes, we are geographically protected to some extent by how difficult it is to get here. But then, of course, look at how the people who are coming in from Latin America, where it's much easier to get here, are treated once they're here.
Right. It seems like they've managed to phrase the question of, can we guarantee that amongst these thousands of refugees there won't be one radical jihadist? And of course, we can't. But it seems ironic to me that, almost every day there's a situation like the shooting in a Planned Parenthood clinic in Colorado Springs, and nobody is saying that we need to get white men out of America because they're killing so many people with guns.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting that there is an effort among some to start labeling those attacks by the white men terrorists, because I think it is important the language we use, and we should be using the same language. But people have a hard time even thinking of terrorism in terms of anything but people from the Muslim community.
Well, I mean, if terrorism is violence with a political motivation, then clearly an attack on... I don't even know if they did abortions in Colorado Springs, but the man presumably thought he was attacking an abortion clinic because of his comments. That's clearly terrorism by the simple definition of a political violence.
Well, that's right, and the also the definition is usually in terms of a non-state actor, but
right.
Then look at the terrorism that's spread by state actors, and we were talking about drones. Think of drones in terms of how the effects of having an aircraft hovering over your head in a community 24 hours a day, terrorizing the entire community. When we were in Yemen, people talked to us about there are about hundreds of thousands of people being terrorized because the U.S. was going after a handful of people. So certainly there's state terrorism.
And there was something I read recently that said that 90% or around 90% of the people killed by U.S. drones in recent years were not the targets of those drones?
Well, there's only a handful of people who are actually listed by name as part of a kill list. The vast majority of people who are killed are people we don't even know. The U.S. just makes up for that by saying, well, they're militants, and we have no idea who they are, and no way of proving that they were militants. That's the terror of these drones is that they don't allow people to surrender. They don't allow anybody to defend themselves in a court of law. And certainly, the U.S. government tries to cover up not only the whole program, but who is being targeted and who is being killed. So, yes, it's really just a very small percentage of people who were actually intended to kill, named, and put onto a kill list.
I think that these same thing applies. Like, one thing that's been noticed about intelligence gathering is that there's been a lot of bulk monitoring of everybody's phone calls, everybody's SMSs, everybody's emails, as opposed to targeted. And the authorities, I think, in France said, well, we didn't have the manpower to follow around these guys who we knew were already radicalized. But the same thing seems to apply to the military, that they would, you know, if after 9/11, they were much more anxious to start a war in Afghanistan rather than go in and get the handful of people who were involved with the 9/11 events.
Well, yes, and a number of us were saying from the very beginning, treat it as a crime against humanity, treat it as something where it needs a policing response, where you go after individuals. But certainly in the case of Iraq, this was already pre-planned, and George Bush and his cohorts wanted to invade Iraq, and this was just the excuse that they used. But it definitely has not been a, quote, successful way of getting back at individuals who attacked us.
So changing subjects a little bit, when you started Code Pink, you obviously had a particular strategy in mind of this visual nonviolent civil disobedience. In other words, like civil disobedience that's making enough of a spectacle that people might want to turn their television cameras to you. Can you describe what your thoughts were when you started Code Pink and how you think it's been successful?
Well, when we started Code Pink, we thought that we would be part of a massive grassroots-based uprising against the idea of going to war with Iraq, a country that had nothing to do with 9/11. And that we were going to do our duty as citizens to stop our country from committing a terrible crime. And in the beginning, it was like that. We were part of a much, much larger movement that managed to get hundreds of thousands of people out onto the streets. There's a new movie that came out called We Are Many, produced by a wonderful UK producer, that shows that this movement against the war in Iraq was a global one, and that it produced the largest demonstrations in the history of humankind. Were we living in real democracies, that should have been enough to stop our governments from going to war, but unfortunately that wasn't the case. So before the war, Code Pink just blossomed. We got hundreds of thousands of people on our mailing list. We had hundreds of local chapters that just cropped up spontaneously. The movement was constantly recruiting new people, young people, old people, diversity. After a couple of years, and after the war itself started, it was much harder to continue that level of protest. And so the peace movement itself, including Code Pink, started declining. And that decline really happened in a major way when President Obama was elected, because people thought that now he was going to solve the problems. Mm-hmm. And the peace movement, I call it the first casualty of the Obama administration. It's been very hard to build up since that. And you talked about our tactics of using a lot of creative visuals to get attention. That's really because our numbers have diminished so much, and it's harder to get media attention these days. So the issues have become more complicated as well. Certainly, we agree that ISIS is terrible, but you know, it was easier to say don't bomb Iraq than it is to convince people that there is no military solution to the problem of ISIS.
I mean, in a simplistic world, do you think that when people talk about the French attacks, like either the Charlie Hebdo attack or the recent attack in several sites in Paris, that if you start to criticize the reaction of governments, the people think that you are pro-ISIS or something? Like, is that an accusation you get?
I know, it's crazy. I mean, if you merely are trying to say that this is not a solution, you do get accused of being pro-ISIS. You do get accused of, for example, we are a women-led group, and people say, well, how can you do that? You're supporting these horrible people who are so who are so abusive towards women. Unfortunately, that very simplistic equation is made by a lot of people. And it's why it's important, I think, to be very clear that you're talking about how do you actually solve these problems.
I suspect that you're not terribly enthusiastic about any of the current Republican candidates, particularly the front runner. Am I correct in that assessment?
Definitely. I would say at one point we thought maybe Rand Paul would take a better position, mm-hmm. but his positions were good until he started running for office, and now they've become pretty bad.
Yes. You evinced some disappointment in Obama, and it seems to me that Hillary Clinton is cut from the same kind of cloth, that she was involved with the bombing of Libya, for example. On the other hand, Obama did sign the agreement with Iran, or he's going to sign it. I don't know what the status of that is. I mean, what's your assessment of Obama's presidency on this? I mean, are there good things, or is it just really been a disaster from the point of view of war and peace?
Well, certainly the Iran deal is a very good thing, and I've been working on the issue of U.S. relations with Cuba for many decades, and it's great to see a breakthrough on that front.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But unfortunately, the majority of Obama's presidency has been continuing along the same lines as George Bush. We talked about the drone program. That's really the signature program of the Obama administration. And Obama has continued these wars. He's allowed himself, I would say rather reluctantly, to be pressured to keep troops in Iraq and Afghanistan. I think he did want to wind down those wars. He promised that he was going to close down the prison in Guantanamo from the time that he was running for office, even when he had the chance to do that in the first 2 years of his presidency, he never did it. So I think he's been a tremendous disappointment, and Hillary Clinton would be even worse than Obama. I mean, she now admits that her vote for the Iraq War was a bad vote, but she did make that vote knowing at the time what the consequences might be.
She hasn't apologized for what happened in Libya, which was supposed to be, you know, overturn a dictator, get democracy, life's going to be wonderful, and it's turned into a disaster.
Right, and she, as Secretary of State, was more militant than many of the people in the Pentagon itself. She was supposed to be the chief diplomat. If you look at the successes diplomatically of the Obama administration, they came after Hillary Clinton. They came when John Kerry became the Secretary of State.
I kind of got the feeling with John Kerry in Syria that it was actually just a stumble that he gave Syria the opening to get rid of their chemical weapons and then America wouldn't bomb them. I wasn't convinced that was strategic as opposed to just a mistake on Kerry's part, although it did stop America from getting involved in one more war.
Well, that too, I think, is a reflection of the opposition among the public. When we saw that the British population was able to turn the tide in the UK and not give the green light for their government to get involved in the war in Syria, that gave us a lot of inspiration here in the U.S. to do the same. So, yes, I don't think that was particularly John Kerry deciding that he was going to seek a diplomatic solution, but in the end, that's what happened. And in the end, I would think that history must say that John Kerry was a much better Secretary of State than Hillary Clinton.
Mm-hmm. I noticed after the tragedy in France, the terrorist attacks recently in France, that Britain was trying to get involved back in Syria. And Canada, which had promised to take out its few airplanes when the government changed from conservative to liberal, was under a lot of pressure to change that. Like the obvious assumption, well, what we're supposed to draw from that is that if a terrorist attack happens, we need more bombing in places like Syria. Even though that has never worked in the past.
Yeah, that's... I don't really understand why politicians go that route. And I don't understand why people are so anxious for that kind of revenge. I guess there's something in human nature about revenge, but it's supposed to be the job of our leaders to lead and to point to ways that are more successful. You rarely ever hear leaders these days talking from a point of view of even just basic kind of compassion, like we talked about this whole refugee crisis and how it was and continues to be one that's based on so much hatred of the other. But I just long for the days when the elected officials would teach people that there are other ways of dealing with extremism and that we have to go to the look at the causes for this, we have to go to the roots, we have to see what we can change in our own societies that would make us less of a target. But it seems like that's not in the cards in terms of people wanting to get elected or
right. Although Obama's been a lot better on the refugees than the Republicans, who've said that they don't want to take a single one, unless you can prove that every single refugee it could not possibly be radicalized, which is impossible.
But even the numbers that Obama's talking about are tiny. Obama's not making the connections really between our own actions and the refugees.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, he does have more of a compassionate tone when he's talking about the why we should support the refugees. That's true.
Yeah, in Canada, you know, we have a new government, which is supposed to be a lot warmer and cuddlier than our previous kind of neoconservative government under Harper. And they had an election platform to take in 25,000 refugees, which is still not a lot, but it's significant. But then they said no single men. And then they said, well, we just want vulnerable refugees. But it seems to me that single men are probably the most vulnerable in some ways, because they're likely to be targets for the radicals if they get left
right.
in camps, right? Like, wouldn't you want to get them out of camps in Turkey where they feel hopeless and maybe there's some... maybe life seems better with a gun on your shoulder than sitting in the camp.
Well, that's right. And wouldn't you try to do whatever you can to keep families together? And single men are usually connected in some way to some part of a larger family. And I think it's sad how single men have really been targeted. You look, there are some places, like in the Scandinavian countries, where they have programs that have really focused on how to provide more opportunities for these single immigrants who come in, and give them a lot of job training and re-education if they've been coming back, for example, from fighting with ISIS. And that's a much better way of dealing with the issue.
Yeah, I mean, I think this was a problem in America with black youth as well, as long as there's a lot of prejudice and it's harder to succeed in society just because you're a young black man or young Muslim man. That isolates you from society, which makes getting involved with crime or terrorism more likely. But it seems like most people don't get that.
Well, that's right. It's just this superficial thing of whether it's not wanting to look back on why we were hated and attacked on 9/11, that was always taboo to go back to ask the question why, or why there's more violence in certain communities, and not to want to go to the roots of problems and solve them from the roots.
I wanted to talk a little bit about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, because you're also involved in that. And you are Jewish, I believe. Is that
yes.
correct? And so is there a lot of difficulty? I think there's now more Jews who are critical of the state of Israel. Is that still a difficult thing in America?
It's really changing, and it's wonderful to see just in the last 10 years this evolution, where now we have major organizations that have cropped up to counter the powerful lobby group like AIPAC that just a decade ago really had a stranglehold on our policies. It was the most powerful, well, it still is really the most powerful foreign lobby group. But in the past, you would see Congress people shaking in their boots that they would be so afraid that they might get on the wrong side of AIPAC, because AIPAC showed that it was able to take out elected officials by targeting them, finding a good candidate to oppose them, funding that candidate. And so you would see that AIPAC would give the good housekeeping seal of approval to candidates, and then they would be beholden to AIPAC. And that really was directly correlated to supporting any policies, even these horrific policies of during the invasions of Gaza by the Israeli government. And in the meantime, the U.S. would just continue to give more and more military aid to Israel. And that hasn't changed in the sense that we're giving more, even more money now to Israel, but it has changed in the sense that Congress people have voted against what AIPAC wanted them to do and survived. And that sends a big message, and it means that in the future, I think we'll be able to drive more of a wedge between U.S. policy and the right-wing activities of the Israeli government.
And I guess the Iran agreement was a good example of that, right? I mean, if the Netanyahu, the Israeli government, definitely did not want that agreement to be signed, and yet it was it was agreed to anyway.
Yes, and it was amazing to see how AIPAC put in tens of millions of dollars into that campaign. And originally people thought, well, you know, money wins and the power of these lobby groups win. To see that it didn't happen and to see AIPAC lose in this major foreign policy debate was a big blow to the organization. And so, yes, you're right. It was really Iran that I think would be the line in the sand that shows that AIPAC can be defeated.
When you were talking about AIPAC, I was thinking that for most of what you said, you could substitute NRA for AIPAC. Because a powerful lobby group that ranks politicians, pours tons of money in it, anybody who goes against them gets defeated. But that's also changing in America, I think. I don't know if you're really into the whole gun debate within the United States.
Well, yes, very much so. And the analogy, I think, is a perfect one. And it really takes us full circle in this interview to the beginning of what all of this have in common, which is the weapons manufacturers, because it's become more and more clear that NRA really represents the weapons industry more than it does individual gun owners. And there's a wonderful movement now of tens of thousands of individual gun owners that say they want logical, rational gun policies. So it's starting to change with the NRA, but we haven't had that major breakthrough the way we have had with AIPAC.
Yeah, I think in both cases, my assessment is that they put forward a really simplistic vision of the world. You know, the focus on the Second Amendment, it's in our Constitution, it's your right. If you don't have a gun, your government's going to come and do bad stuff to you. When you step back and think about it, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense, but it seems, a lot of people seem to buy it. I guess it's like Donald Trump is saying the most outrageous things, and yet a significant portion of the population is buying it.
Well, yes, it's so sad that people, I mean, I'm very skeptical of my government, but I don't think that having my own gun is going to protect me from my government.
Well, actually, quite the opposite. I think if you stocked your house with machine guns and they found out about it, they'd show up with tanks and helicopters. It doesn't matter what you have. They have more.
That's right. And but it is interesting the comparisons that have made between Canada and the United States, where Canada has doesn't have more gun owners per person than the United States, but way less violence.
Well, I don't know, but that's possible. We have more restrictions. Like, I'm pretty sure that the AR-15, those semi-automatic weapons, would not be allowed in Canada. And gun ownership is just not the same. Like, you don't get the same rhetoric coming out of gun owners in Canada. I mean, there are occasional backlashes. Like, we had a big flood here, and our police force, the RCMP, went around empty houses, and they seized guns that were out in the open for a safety purpose. They didn't want those guns getting the wrong houses. And some of the gun owners were upset that they were seizing their guns, even though they gave them back afterwards. But to me, it was a simple issue of safety. If there's empty houses with guns sitting on the kitchen table, then anybody could go in and take the gun. But that's a rare event in Canada. Usually gun owners aren't anywhere near as loud. Although our former government did destroy our gun registry, which some people thought was very useful. But it clearly is different than in the United States.
Yeah, sure. And here we just keep saying after each massacre that occurs in the United States that, you know, this will be the one that will lead to the kind of reforms that we've been calling for and are disappointed time and time and time again. And so you wonder, what is it going to take in the United States for us to be able to stand up to the NRA and get some rational kind of controls on who can have guns and what kind of guns they can have?
Yeah, well, to close, I mean, what does give you hope for the future? You've been at this a long time, and you're still at it, so you have something has to keep you going.
Well, things like the Iran deal was a huge shot in the arm to see that we could accomplish that. seeing that we're able to have some breakthroughs in diplomatic efforts, like the Cuba one is a very positive thing.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
We also work on individual cases of people who've been locked up in places from Egypt to Saudi Arabia and have been successful many times at getting people released from prison, which is so wonderful to see them out of death row and back into their communities. We've seen people released from Guantanamo because of campaigns that we've been involved in. So the successes are small, but they're important and much better than not doing anything. And I think the people that we get involved with, seeing the tremendous courage of people who have less rights than we do, a lot less rights than we do, but stand up to the their own repressive governments is tremendously inspiring and makes us feel like we have to take advantage of the democratic rights that we still have in our countries to stand up for what we believe in.
Well, thank you, Medea, for joining me today. I really appreciate your time.
Great. I enjoyed the interview. Thank you so much.
Okay. Goodbye.
Bye-bye, David.
Thank you for listening to another episode of The Infectious Myth. If you have a comment, question, or suggestion for a future guest, please email me at david.curro@theinfectiousmyth.com or join the discussion at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth or follow us on Twitter at infectiousmyth. If you would like to sponsor the show individually or as an advertiser, we would definitely appreciate your support, so please contact me. But what is more important than money is the fact that you listen to the show, that you let your friends know about it, and that you keep sending me comments and ideas for future guests. I really do appreciate all of that. Until next week, goodbye.